Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hello, I'm Susan Violante. I'm your host for today. I'm really excited to be speaking on the phone with Dr. Rick Neese, author of Sayar Superhero, a book that will take the reader to that fuzzy feeling of small towns while introducing them to a different kind of hero. Definitely a great read for people who love the heartfelt peace small town America gives, as well as life-changing lessons discovered within remarkable characters. But before we start, let's learn a little bit more about Rick. Rick Neese is a lifelong educator who has served as a classroom teacher, a public school administrator, and a university professor, provost, and president. In 1997, he was named president of the University of Ozarks in Quaxley, Arkansas, and remains steadfast in his devotion to the university's success. After his retirement on July 1, 2013, he was named president emeritus in the University of the Ozarks. Dr. Neese is a recipient of multiple awards, both as an author and an educator. He and his wife, Cherie, are now retired and living in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. Rick is now able to devote more time to his writing. For more information on Rick and his book, visit www.rickneesebooks.com, and that is Rick, N-I-E-C-E, books.com. Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hello, I'm Susan Violante. I'm your host for today. I'm really excited to be speaking on the phone with Dr. Rick Neese, author of Sayar Superhero, a book that will take the reader to that fuzzy feeling of small towns while introducing them to a different kind of hero. Definitely a great read for people who love the heartfelt peace small town America gives, as well as life-changing lessons discovered within remarkable characters. But before we start, let's learn a little bit more about Rick. Rick Neese is a lifelong educator who has served as a classroom teacher, a public school administrator, and a university professor, provost, and president. In 1997, he was named president of the University of Ozarks in Quaxley, Arkansas, and remains steadfast in his devotion to the university's success. After his retirement on July 1, 2013, he was named president emeritus in the University of the Ozarks. Dr. Neese is a recipient of multiple awards, both as an author and an educator. He and his wife, Cherie, are now retired and living in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. Rick is now able to devote more time to his writing. For more information on Rick and his book, visit www.rickneesebooks.com, and that is Rick, N-I-E-C-E, books.com. Hi, Rick. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It is my honor, Susan.
I am so happy to have you here because I remember the book last year in the awards, and I remember that it was we were actually fighting for it because it's my feeling that your book takes people to back when the things were simple and when simplicity in our feelings was important, and there's some kind of warm feeling about your book that I really, really enjoy.
Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, that's about the highest compliment you can pay me. I was raised in a very small town in Ohio, a town of 900. And that sense of community and that sense of belonging has followed me throughout my whole life and my career. And I like the fact then that other people can read my works and feel welcomed in, almost like a sense of community that I felt and try to establish in my writing.
Yes. And you accomplished it. You really accomplished it with this book. Before we go, I do wonder if our listeners might have this question in their brain right now. What is exactly a Sayar hero? Well, I mean, the title is so
yes,
so different.
Yeah. And the title, even without the, because as you know, a cover is so important for a book. Sayar Superhero, in this small town of DeGraff, Ohio, When I was 9 years old, I took over a paper route that had 72 customers. Now, that was a big responsibility for a 9-year-old, and I had a lot of quirky customers and customers I really cared about, but there was one customer who was very, very special to me, and that was a young man with very severe cerebral palsy. And if people can visualize what severe cerebral palsy does to someone, he was confined to a wheelchair, had no control over any part of his body, his arms, his legs, his head, and was very, very difficult to understand. His universe, his world, was pretty much this small side yard where I would deliver the paper to him and would have about 10 or 15 minutes of conversation with him during the day. And the highlight of our conversation would be when I would read the Dick Tracy comic strip to him. And Dick Tracy was a real hero to us, and we were just very upset about the villains who tried to interfere with Dick Tracy's police work. But from that, as I looked back on my childhood and the influences of my childhood, I realized that this young man in this small side yard was a superhero. Not a superhero like kids think of today who could fly or could bend steel, or but one of those superheroes that we come in contact with and oftentimes don't recognize until potentially years later, or maybe tragically never recognize. So the side yard superhero is this young man on my paper route in DeGraff. I had that paper out until I was 17 years old. And the friendship we developed and the life lessons that I learned from him on a day-to-day basis.
I can imagine that. And it's amazing that that somebody will teach you life lessons when you wonder what type of life can he talk about always on the wheelchair. And
oh, gosh, that's, you know, I almost get fixated on that sometimes because his life was, this was a time, too, and I think it's very important for your listeners to understand, this was a time when there was really no ADA, there was no special education. As far as his name was Bernie Jones, and as far as I know, Bernie never had any formal education whatsoever, or because we were a small, isolated town that was a long way from any big city like Columbus, or Dayton, Ohio. I don't know that he ever had any kind of physical therapy at all. So, but what was amazing when I think about life lessons, I never in all those years heard Bernie complain once.
Wow.
And because of that, and then I ended up going into education and being a university president, among some other administrative duties, I have found that I have no tolerance for complainers. In fact, I don't listen to complainers because I think back to this person I knew who had everything to complain about and never once complained and somehow made that side yard his world and his universe and seemed to be content. Now, when I say that, you know, certainly in any relationship, you know, in any friendship, you only get, you know, through so many walls, but never heard him complain, and that to me was a life lesson that I've carried and tried to pass on to others.
Yeah, well, have you seen him after you left for college? Did you get to see him as a grown man?
You know, I think I can say this and not be a spoiler of the book. The book begins in the present time, about four decades after I had gone from DeGraff. And there was a point about 5 or 6 years, the last time I saw Bernie, the last day that I delivered the paper, and I'd explained to him I was going to Ohio State University and I'd be giving my paper out to my brother, was a terrifically difficult day. And even though I explained to Bernie things weren't really going to change, obviously in his world that was a 180-degree turn for him, I promised him that I would see him again, that I would come back and return and see him. Well, as you know, unfortunately, life, career, things get in the way, and I completely lost track of him. I did go back about 6 years later, but found that he no longer lived there. His parents had passed away, and he no longer lived there, and I lost complete track of him. And that was certainly before social media allowed you to easily find someone. So I'd lost track with him then for probably at that time about 34, 35 years. The book begins when I receive a late-night telephone call from my mother. My mother is calling to tell me that she knows where Bernie Jones is, that he is in a nursing home in Ohio. And the premise of the book, then, is me returning to see Bernie after all these decades. But Bernie's the story arc. It also gives me a chance to reflect upon a childhood in this small town and the characters in this small town. So as to answer your question specifically, yes, I got to spend the most marvelous afternoon with Bernie 40 years after the last time I had seen him.
That's awesome. Is this visit what inspired your book, or did you already have an inspiration to write about him?
That's another terrific question. I'm a former English teacher. I was an English major in college, so I've always enjoyed the written word and kind of dabbling in it myself. And I found that during my speeches, as a president, I would have to give a number of speeches, that somehow I was incorporating characters and things from my childhood into my speeches. One day my wife said to me, you know what, you're going to forget these stories. You need to start writing them down. And I don't know how your writing style is, but, you know, sometimes we put off those things, and I don't know why it is. Everybody's going to write a book, right, Susan? Everybody's got something they're going to write a book. Very few of us get it written.
Yeah.
So my wife's words then, combining that with having seen Bernie again, really had all these things rushing back to me, and that's when I decided I need to sit down now and write this story.
And you did a wonderful job at it, and I want to mention to our listeners that they can check out more about your book and the other books that you have coming up and that you wrote. I think this one was your first one, right?
This is the first book in a series, and at this point I'm planning to be a series of three. The second book, entitled The Band Plays On, is also published, and it is available to people. And right now, I stopped writing. You're going to appreciate this. I stopped my writing on the third book to talk to you.
Okay.
Oh, so I'm feverishly working on book number three.
Great. That's how it's done. No stopping.
That is how it's done. And people fool themselves. It's just funny. People fool themselves into thinking they're going to sit down and write something, but they never do. Writing is really difficult, as you know, and finding the time to write. And then sometimes you find the time, and somehow the inspiration isn't hitting you. But you have to sit down and write that first sentence, that first paragraph, that first page, and then you're into the process. But it has to get started.
Mm-hmm. You know that I always believed, and actually a phone of mine, they got published many years ago. I call it the storyteller, because I do believe that writers, we just not write to put words to our thoughts and share them. I really think it's that we just want to fill our brain and our lives with the stories of other people and what we see and experience that life, and we just have to make room for it, and so that's why we write. And that's been my conviction. But I read on your blog something that really touched me. And I think, I can't remember exactly how it went, but basically what I got from it is that you consider yourself a memory keeper.
Yes.
Is this why you write?
Yeah, that's, in fact, I was going to name this first book. I was thinking about the series being titled The Memory Keeper, but there is a book out. It was put out several years ago. It's called The Memory Keeper. Yeah, I believe when we are born, we are divided into two sections just before birth. In one section are the memory makers, and the other section are the memory keepers. Now, we all know those memory makers, the people who are always fun at a party, the best friend you have, the people who always know the right thing to say at the right time. Then I think there are those of us who are the memory keepers. We're the ones who watch, who observe everything, and who observe it and then store it and keep it for ourselves for the most part. But then if we're writers, we can share those with others. So, yeah, I've been blessed, I think, by having a very sharp memory, although I think it's probably a selective memory. And, I like the thought of being a memory keeper. I think I probably got that from my mother, because my mother was a wonderful observer of people. And she would always kind of have stories about people she didn't know. We might be sitting in an airport, and later she would say, you know, I think that person or I think that couple, and would always have stories about them. So I think that that sense of being observant, especially about people, started with my mother. And fortunately, I think I've been a good memory keeper and then can share those memories with others.
And that's a beautiful way of putting it. It never occurred to me that way, but in a sense, we all writers kind of keep memories, whether we know it or not, in our work. I want to tell our listeners where to read more from you, and it's your website is ricknesebooks.com.
Yes, it is, Susan. That's correct.
And that is ricknesebooks.com. I encourage everybody to read your blog. I read your blog, and it was like going back to my hometown. I felt, you know, and this is in South America, totally different background.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So, I got that warm, fuzzy feeling when I read your blog, and everything in your website kind of made me feel that I was in this small little town, that everybody was friendly. What is it about time in a small town that makes us feel so fuzzy and warm and good?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think small towns are like another set of parents or a favorite aunt and uncle. I think small towns look out for the youngsters in that town. Oftentimes, when the parents' eyes aren't there, the small towns are looking out for them. And although in a small town, word travels fast and there's no real privacy in a small town, I think that sense of looking out for one another and taking care of one another and really knowing one another. I mean, this was a time, and I think almost logistically you can see the difference I'm going to set up. This was a time when people sat on their front porches and welcomed people onto the front porch with them. Now, if you think how houses are configured, there are very few front porches. It's almost closed-in patios. Where people kind of isolate themselves. I understand that because the hecticness of life now, sometimes you need that sense of privacy, I think. But I think that idea of getting to know one another, watching out for one another, and it was also a real joy for me as a young boy to have a paper out and then to really get to know people within that small town. I do think, as a university president, you know, we had a number of students, and I see a number of backgrounds. I think the other thing about a small town is there were four things in small towns that I think were the big influence on people who lived in that town. Number one was the sense of community. Number two was church. Number three, family. And number four, school. Because at that time, small towns had their own schools. There wasn't all the consolidation of small schools and small towns becoming bigger schools. And I'm not certain that the kids today have all four of those, or maybe even one or two of those that are going for them. So I think that sense of all of that I'm talking about, community, family, church, school, all comprised what that feel of a small town was.
It is, and even if you're not in, you know, part of that town, just you're just visiting, you can feel that energy. You can feel those that warmth.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Rick Nees, author of Sayar Superhero. Stay tuned because we are going to continue this personal and inspiring conversation with Rick about his book's inspiration, Bernie Jones, Small Town America, and writing as his way to be a memory keeper. But in the meantime, you can check out his book, Sayar Superhero, by visiting his website at www.rickneesbooks.com, and that is Rick, N-I-E-C-E, books.com. Then you can feel a sense of security that you don't feel in bigger places where there's a detachment, if you may, between people.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think also, in the book I mentioned that we never locked our doors. And I had one of our neighbors say, gee, if somebody needs to come into my house and steal something, they need it more than I need it. Mm-hmm. So they need to go ahead and take it. Well, that kind of philosophy doesn't exist anymore. I did have a reviewer from Chicago, and it was a really nice review, but she said, I could not identify with any of your book unless I read it as being fiction, because nothing like this in my mind could exist. And I thought that was an interesting observation, where she could identify with it, but only on the sense of being fiction, not being nonfiction.
Wow, that is kind of sad, though. That,
it is, and I think you ask, in a sense, why I wrote the book. Really, two reasons, I think, other than my wife's encouragement and having seen Bernie. This is a time, I think, when people do like to look back nostalgically. And I think, I've been amazed at how many people have read the book, contacted me and said, guys, this makes me want to write my story, or I really identified so much with this or with that. But I also wanted to write it for young people who might never have experienced something like this. And I think of some of the books that I would read when I was, you know, growing up, and it might be about Daniel Boone, or it might be about the founding of New York City or whatever. And I really enjoyed being able to be a part of whatever that world was. And I'm hoping through my books that people who never experienced it, might never experience it, can at least have a sense of what life was and hopefully still can be.
Mm-hmm. Very, very well said. And that takes me to a term that can be utilized to classify your writing style on these books. And hopefully, and I'm not even sure that I know how to pronounce it. So it
automythography.
Yes. What is
automythography? Yes. That's automythography. If you think of autobiography, but replace the by with myth, that is automythography, and that's how it would be spelled. A-U-T-O, you know, mythography.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that I had created this term, automythography. So the book's getting ready to be published. I thought, maybe I better Google it. Well, I found out the term had been around since the 1980s, but it did not apply to literature. It was primarily applying to African dance.
Oh, wow.
And the idea that before the written word, people would pass down stories generation to generation through dance. And I was intrigued by that. So I thought, you know, I'll define automythography for literature. And my definition is, an automythography is a work of nonfiction that looks reflectively at what we think we remember and how we think we remember it. It's an iridescent memory based upon the author's truth and fact. Within that, I think there are two key points. One is iridescent, and the other is the author's truth and fact. Everything's true, but it's based upon the author's memory and truth and fact. The best way to explain this is, iridescent is a key word in the definition. A soap bubble is iridescent. As it floats away from us, a soap bubble changes shapes and colors, but it's the same soap bubble. I think the older we get, our memories float away from us. They change shapes and colors, but they're the same memory. So for me, an automythography isn't myth in the terms of something being made up, but it's the passing down of stories from one generation to another. I think another theme that occurs in my books is that concept of echoing, something that echoes. That people echoed things to me that, as a memory keeper, I have kept, and now it's my responsibility to echo those things forward, to tell those stories forward, hence auto-mythography.
That's awesome. I can see it. No, actually, I can really see it with the example of the bubble, because that's basically what I encounter when I was trying to put down my dad's
yes.
story in the book, and he would remember things that I knew the fact on history, but the way he experienced it and the way that they got engraved in his mind were different.
Yeah, boy, you hit it exactly. And when you have relatives who read your book, they're going to remember the facts, but they might remember things a little bit, the nuances differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make what you're saying untrue, but it is based upon your facts and how you collected those facts and how those facts have, marinated.
Mm-hmm.
Marinated in your head over the years. I have had people ask, was everything in your book true? And I'll say, everything is absolutely true, so much so that three times I've been back to DeGraff, this small town, for book signings. And what I love about that small town is most of the people still live there. My classmates, for the most part, still live there. Well, when you're signing a book to somebody who's in the book, your facts had better be correct. You know, you better have not made up anything. And I did tell one interviewer one time, said, well, are any of the names fictional? And I said, yes, there are three or four names that are fictional, but that is not to protect the innocent, it's protect the guilty.
That's a very good point. Oh, Lord. But I found what you're saying very, very true.
Yeah.
Also, when I was interviewing my mom, because she's going to be part of another book, and her cousin was there, and now this is an 83-year-old woman is my cousin, and my mom is an 80-year-old, and they both got the same experience because they were basically on the same house during World War II. And they would argue like you have no idea, you know, when they were talking about it. I have it all on tape, how they argue about it. Because what my mom would take things in one way, my aunt, I call her aunt, had taken it in a different way, you know, talking about their childhood. So it's so
true. Susan, that is a perfect example. And if you ever want to utilize the term, either formally or informally, automythography, please feel free to do that. I really think it's a genre that should stand apart, because autobiographies are when people write about themselves, and for me, automythographies are when people write about their memories. So there really isn't a genre like that. It's memoir-like, but it's not exactly a memoir. It's autobiography-like, but it's not exactly an autobiography. So I really do think that's a genre that it can exist on its own.
I'm going to look into this, because you just gave me an idea of an editorial, and with your permission, I would love to write my next editorial about this word.
You certainly have my permission. You certainly have it.
It's very interesting. Before we go, we're coming to the end of our time, unfortunately, because I find this conversation very interesting. But before we go, I would like to see what advice can you give any aspiring writers, or even writers that are just beginning and they're struggling to get those words on paper?
Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing I'm going to say is going to sound cliched, but then I'll explain it. Write what you know. And a lot of writers give that advice, write what you know. But probably the biggest influence on me as a writer was the poet William Carlos Williams, was an American poet in the early 20th century. But his poetry was okay, but his philosophy of writing was what I was really fascinated about. And he said, write about the local. Too many people try to write about the universal before they understand and know the local. Write about the local. Well, that would be my advice. Write about what you know. Write about the local. And what better example than the book Sideyard Superhero? How much more local can you get than a person's small side yard in this small town in Ohio? That's what I know about. I'm fascinated by people who can write fiction, who can write science fiction. I can't make stuff up. My imagination is not that fertile. Write what you know. Be it people, be it experiences, be it one experience. Write what you know and start there.
That's a great, very, very good point. Start there, and then let's see where that takes you.
Exactly.
And be open to it, yeah. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Again, for our readers, your website is ricknieceBooks.com, and that's ricknieceBooks.com. Encourage everybody to check out your book, The Cy Yard Superhero. Definitely, Bernie Jones is very worth meeting in your book.
Yeah.
So,
thank you so much, Susan.
Oh, no, thank you. And I hope to talk to you sometime about your other books. And thank you again.
I look forward to it.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Okay. And to you, listeners, thank you for being with us. And until next time.